See, songs have a funny way of worming their way into our brains and not leaving, right? Never letting go. Parents, you know what I'm talking about. VBS songs, right? You got the CD in your car and bubbling up. Remember that one from last year, right? It's coming again. 2 weeks from now, it's coming again. Ours are already rolling in our car. But maybe it's not VBS songs for you. But you can surely remember that song that you had on that 8-track in your car that you had just repeating over and over again, right? Like, remember that? The cat's in the cradle and the... Right, you remember every lyric to that. As soon as it comes on, you know the words. They just worm in there and they stick. There's something about songs that do that. They're incredible tools to get us to remember things, too. Maybe you learned a song back in school, like when you had to learn the periodic table, and maybe you learned a song to somehow remember that. Or the books of the Bible, we've got a song that we've learned with our boys that helps understand the order of the books of the Bible. There's songs, mnemonic devices to help us remember things because they stick in our brains. Well, did you know that the original collection of hit songs is actually right there in front of you? Like the book of Psalms is a collection of songs and prayers and hymns that they would sing. And they are poems really meant to give God's people a voice in their emotions that they might not have ever experienced before. Like these are real people experiencing real emotions and real things, and they're expressing these things to God and recorded in God's word, allowing us to then have the same voice that we might not have had otherwise. And they're actually songs we can sing. You're going to see over, if you're on Facebook in our group, you're going to see, I'm going to post over the next few weeks, regularly songs that are written straight from the Psalms. We're going to sing many of these songs that are straight from the Psalms. Better Is One Day is one of those. You'll see some of the same language in Psalm 27 today that we just sang in Better Is One Day. Again, Psalm 83 is word for word, Better Is One Day. These are actually songs we can sing, but they're actually prayers we can pray as well. Like if you ever get stuck when you're praying, you're just like, I don't know what to say, and just repeat the same words. Just open up Psalms and start praying what you read. Because these are originally prayers and songs and hymns and poems written to God. So as you might know, this year we're focusing on prayer. So it's a year-long focus. And what we want to do with this summer and these Psalms, these songs that we're going to study, we want to help shape your prayers. Because here's the thing, so often we can pray differently in good times and bad times. What we want to do is give you a voice that you might not be able to pray one of those two very well. You're going to see some Psalms this summer that will help shape your prayers maybe in times of joy or times of sorrow differently. Because we all hit those times. So we'll be in the Psalms all summer. So put your bookmark there. Okay, so you know, shifting a little bit to more of a personal, you know how when you're attracted to somebody, like you can do some really silly things, can't you? Remember, think about maybe back in elementary school, for some reason we thought it was a good idea that if you like somebody, you hit them. Like, it doesn't make any sense, but that's how it worked, right? You had a laser focus on this person you were wanting, a boy or a girl. You're like, I want to get with them, and so I'm going to try to get close to them, and then I'm going to hit them. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Or maybe you did this. The little note, do you like me? Yes or no? Maybe. Like, what do you do if you get that one back? Like, maybe. Were you really wanting to check that box? Maybe I like you. Like, I don't think that's a good idea. But anyway, it's silly stuff, but we do that, right? Now, the thing is, we typically don't grow out of that. Like, we do some silly stuff even as we get older. Like, just, you know, this is going to be full disclosure here. So, when I was in high school, there was a girl I was attracted to, and I was trying to impress her. And she lived on a cul-de-sac, and so I'm in my little Chevy S10, 85 S10. It was awesome. But you park on the side, right? And so you're driving around, and I'm trying to impress her. So I'm driving, and I'm pulling out, and I'm trying to stare at her as I'm driving this way, and I'm trying to, you know, like, wave and be all cool, right? I failed to notice her brick mailbox on the other side of the driveway, and yeah, it went right over. Not so cool, by the way. Her dad was not happy about that. Now, it might not be that for you. Like, you don't have that kind of laser focus. You don't really feel that. Okay, well, you might have experienced a different kind of obsession or laser focus. Like, some people are obsessed with their kids, where it's completely setting the direction of your family's life based on their activities. It's almost like the earth revolving around the sun. You revolve your entire family's life around the kids' activities rather than setting the priorities for them. Or you think about some people have a laser focus who like to hunt or fish, right? You think of how much time and money and thoughts, and their calendar is based on when this time opens and closes, right? Or some people are obsessed with having the yard of the month, and they want to have this perfect yard. Now some of you are like, that's not me. Just wait till I get a notice on the door, then I'll cut the weeds down. Like, that's how you work. But some people are laser focused on that. Or some people work themselves to death because they want to have a promotion, or they want to have a little bit more money. And so at the expense of their family, they work up the corporate ladder, and they're obsessed with that. Now, other obsessions we have are a little bit more hazardous. Some people are just living for the next high they can get from alcohol or drugs or pornography or whatever else. Or others spend their lives trying to have the mythical perfect body. All these supplements and all these diets and everything, mythical perfect body, because they saw it on a magazine cover, all in the pursuit of trying to impress people that they don't even really like. See, all of us have some sort of obsession. Whether we want to admit it or not, we are obsessed with something. But here's the rub today. Every obsession that we have, every focus that we place our lives on in this world is futile. Ecclesiastes calls it vanity. My prayer today is that you see something better than obsessing over this world, obsessing over everything, that you see something is better. And so the big idea this morning, you can see it on the notes in your bulletin if you've got one. The big idea this morning is this: that Christ Jesus desires a one thing focus on him no matter what is going on around us. Christ desires a one thing focus on him no matter what is going on around us. And here in Psalm 27, we're going to see four truths that kind of fill that idea out. First, we can have a one thing focus because we can trust him. We can have a one thing focus because we can trust him. Again, Psalm 27 is where we are. Look at the first three verses. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Of whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war arise against me, yet I will be confident. So the author of this psalm that we know is King David. Remember David and Goliath's fame, right? This is David that is now the king. Yet here, he's looking around and he sees that he's in a pretty dangerous spot. He's alone. There's many people trying to kill him. He is rightly afraid, rightly worried with these enemies pressing in on him. But look at David's response each time. The Lord is my light. The Lord is my salvation. The Lord is my stronghold. He says, I can be confident in this Lord. I can trust God. Now, how is he so certain about that, right? There's enemies all around. How is he so certain that he can trust God, that he's his salvation? Because God had delivered him before. Right? Remember David's life many times against animals, against Goliath, against other enemies already. God had delivered him before. So David's thinking, why won't he do it again? Why would God not do it now? If he's done it so many times, why wouldn't he do it again? And so I can be confident in him. See, it doesn't matter the size of the enemy here in David's face, the enemy of the size of the army, the size of the man in front of him, it doesn't matter because his God's the champion, not him. Goliath, 9 feet tall, right? One stone. It was God who killed Goliath ultimately. God's the champion. And so David has this confidence that his God is greater than whatever he's going to face. And it's no different for us, right? We can have this one thing focus on God because we can trust him. Because he's going to come through. Christ is our champion. He has victory over sin and death. He is trustworthy. It doesn't matter the size of the problem in our face. Remember, Jesus is the real giant here. And David's looking at God like, man, there's nothing you can't handle. This is scary. Thousands of people trying to kill me. But there's nothing too big for you, God. So you can trust your life to Jesus too. Your problems, your future, you can confidently place your life in his hands because he can handle it as the king of the universe. So that's the first point. Second point is this, that we can have a one thing focus because we find joy in him. We can have a one thing focus because we find joy in him. Look at verses 4-6. One thing have I asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. And now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me. And I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. Like, so David, here, get the picture again. David's faced with all these enemies around him. He is not in a safe place right now. Yet, he prays. But notice the shock of his prayer here. He doesn't ask, what does he ask for? In the middle of his trouble, David doesn't ask first for deliverance. He asks first for God himself. Now, isn't that different from what we tend to ask God for when we get in trouble? Like, our first reaction is, God, take this problem away. God, take this issue away. Deliver me from this. Fix my issues that I see in my life. God, take it away. Basically, we want a useful God. We want a cosmic doctor in the sky to simply fix our problem. But verse 4 here is where we get this idea of one thing focus that I've been talking about. Verse 4 is saying that no matter what was going on around him, David could have a complete focus on God himself, on God alone. No matter what he sees, no matter what is facing him, my focus can be on God. I can dependently entrust my life to this God and focus solely on him. And so notice what the one thing is that he prays for in verse 4. Which if you really look at it, it seems to be like three things that he actually asks for. But it's the one thing focus. First, to dwell in God's house. Well, what does that mean? It's to be in the shelter of God's presence. He's secure in the walls of God's house. The second, he wants to gaze upon God's beauty. He wants to look with affection and to stare intently at this beautiful God. And third, to inquire in God's temple. He wants to ask of God and to meditate on his response. He wants to be in relationship with God. And he asks God to help him seek these things. Which when you think about it, all three of these things end in God himself, don't they? Like it's not about what the end of each one of those, it's the fact that he gets to be with God. That's the point. It's God's house, God's beauty, God's temple. So get this, David's one thing focus in the end is God. God himself. So think back to our main point then. Christ desires us to have a one thing focus on him. For us to seek him with all of our hearts. Not just what he can give us, but to actually seek him with all that we are. It's kind of like searching for buried treasure. The X that marks the spot on the map is Jesus. And in fact, he is himself the treasure. It's the way Matthew 13:45 says it. The kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value went and sold all that he had and bought it. He saw, this thing is worth me giving everything else up for. I want that one. See, Jesus desires us to have that same kind of devotion to him, that one thing devotion, seeing him as valuable, seeing him as most important. He wants us to be focused on that, on him, that his presence is better than anything else, that his presence is sweeter than anything else, that he's more beautiful than anything else. All other contenders are less beautiful. He fulfills our desires. Psalm 73:25 puts it well. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there's nothing on earth that I desire besides you. Now, does that mean you can't desire food? You can't desire relationship? No, he's not saying that. He's saying, compared to how much I desire you, God, it's like there's nothing else. That's the desire that he has for us to have for him. And so get this, because we find our highest joy in Jesus, we can have a one thing focus on him. And now get the, I'm not talking about happiness with like a goofy grin on your face that's just dependent on your circumstances. Like we were at the putt-putt place and one of the ball drop games gave us jackpots, like three in a row. Like that's a pretty cool thing. To get a $5 piece of plastic. But you see, like, that's a pretty cool thing. And you see a smile because of the circumstances of joy, or what we call joy, but it's happiness, right? Because then you get a zero and you're pretty sad about it. We're not talking about just goofy grins, denying reality, happiness. We're talking about deep, true, lasting joy, which does not depend on your circumstances. There's a difference between happiness and joy. Joy lasts. Happiness is temporary. Joy means you can still cry. Don't think you can't, but you can still have a joy that lasts through tears and through grief. So how do we get that? Like if we want that, we want that kind of joy that lasts through enemies trying to kill me, like David had. We want that joy. How do we get it? Third point, we can have a one thing focus because he gives it to us. We want this focus. We want that. How do we get it? Because he gives it to us. Psalm 27, verses 7 through 12. Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud, I pray. Be gracious to me and answer me. Give me what I'm asking for, is what he said. You've said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, do I seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger. O, you have been my help. Cast me not off. Forsake me not, O God of my salvation. For my father and my mother have forsaken me, meaning the closest people to me have let me go, but the Lord will take me in. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. Give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and they breathe out violence. Now, we see here him asking for it and God giving it, this one thing focus, that God promises to give it to us. But notice that it often comes in trials and struggles and everyone turning their back on you. That's when you get the one thing focus on God. But that means that we can have a confidence and a boldness that even when we walk into incredible difficulties and people are against us, all of the world seems to be against us, we can still have a one thing focus on him. Where with the hymn writer Horatio Spafford, we can say, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well. It is well with my soul. Whatever my lot, like that means, When you're in David's shoes and everybody's against you, you can still say, this is my lot. You've taught me to say, God, you've given this to me. It's well with my soul. It's well with my soul. That's what happens when you seek him. When you're seeking him, pursuing him, looking for him, that's what he gives you. But verse 8 said, seek God's face. How do we seek God's, what does that mean to seek God's face? Like, are we talking like facial structure and cheekbones and how his jawline, are we seeking his face? Is that what we're talking about here? No, think about how we know one another. How do you know when somebody walks in the room? How do you know them? You know them by their face, right? You recognize them. And we identify the person, the character qualities that they have, their quality of who they are and their lifestyle. We identify the person based on what we see. Because if we know them, we know what goes with the face. Just think about the feelings you have when you see a picture, a headshot of Hitler. Like, it's just his face, it's just a picture of him, but you know what's behind it. Or when you see a picture of Billy Graham, like you see a different feel come up. Or when you see a picture of your grandmother, right? You have these feelings come up because you see a picture of her face. Or when you see a picture of your son, you have these feelings that come with it, and you have these understandings of who they are that comes with their face. So when he says seek God's face, all that means is we're simply seeking him. In an intimate, knowing kind of way, we're seeking God. Your face, O Lord, do I seek, meaning I want to know you intimately. And God says he will give us that kind of one thing focus. He's going to give it, and he will give us joy too. He said, I'll give you these things that you're asking for, David. I mean, just listen to what Paul prays in Colossians 1, verse 11. Now, he's talking to believers who are in very similar trials to what David is in right now. Listen to what he writes. May you be strengthened with all power according to his glorious might for all endurance and patience with joy. Right? They're in trouble. He's like, you can be strengthened with endurance and patience with joy. And that patience is what leads us to the fourth point today, that we can have a one thing focus even as we wait. We can have one thing focus on God even as we wait. This is verses 13 and 14 of Psalm 27. He says, I believe that I will look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. So David here is acknowledging that this deliverance he's asking for, it might not come immediately. Even if he dies, he knows that this God that he's talking to, this God that he knows is good and will deliver on his promises. That I'm going to wait on God. I don't understand the plan always, but I'm going to wait on God, and he is going to come through for me. I'm going to seek him, and he's going to come through for me. I don't know what that looks like always, but he's going to come through for his people. That's what gave David courage and confidence and strength to wait, to have endurance, to have patience. Now, when you hear the term wait, what do you typically think? You think of a waiting room to the doctor's office where you're sitting there just constantly waiting and not doing anything. Now, when we hear the term waiting in Scripture, it's an active term. It's not just sitting on the couch twiddling your thumbs, waiting for God to do something, and you're just going to hope he comes through. Waiting is an active term where you're not just sitting in the corner. You're depending on God. You're trusting in God. You're actively walking to obey him and seek him. That means you're not just sitting back. You're doing something. You're pursuing him, and you're seeing that he's coming through in the process for you. See, waiting is active. Waiting means you don't just kind of Jesus take the wheel stuff. I'm going to sit over here and do nothing. Like, yes, Jesus is driving. You're not driving. You're not, he's not your co-pilot. Let me just rant on that. Like the bumper sticker, Jesus is my co-pilot. No, he's not. He's the pilot. You're sitting in the other seat. Get that, right? Like, you're not driving your life. Jesus is, should be, at least. And so when Jesus take the wheel, Carrie Underwood, like, Jesus take the wheel, you're saying, Jesus, I want you to direct my life. So when I wait, even, it means, God, I'm seeking you. What direction do you want this to go? I need the next step. I want you. I want to walk. I'm trusting Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 that you are going to direct my paths. That means I'm actively walking down a path. He's going to direct those paths as we go if we're seeking him. He doesn't want you to direct your path. He wants him to direct your path. And we must seek him to do that. But that's waiting. See, listen, that's waiting. It's an active term. It means we're seeking him, we're pursuing him, we're obeying him, and he will get us where we need to be. But the question is, sometimes that waiting seems like it's a little bit longer than we want. Right? For whatever thing you're waiting for from God, spouse, child, a rebellious child to return, financial provision, new job, career direction, whatever you're waiting for, it might seem like it's taken a little bit longer than you would like it to. And the temptation is to say, you know what, God, maybe you don't really have my good in store. And we saw Abraham take things into his own hands, and it didn't go well. Ishmael came, and the lineage that started from that came, instead of waiting on God to provide Isaac, that he was going to anyway. So how do we rejoice when we wait? Especially when the waiting seems like it's a little bit longer, and it seems like maybe God's not going to come through with what he promised. First of all, you have to understand maybe he didn't promise you what you're waiting for. And maybe it's a selfish thing you're looking for. Maybe it's something that he never promised in his word to give you. Be careful, because then you can get pretty bitter against God if you're waiting for something that he's not actually promised to give you. But what if it is? What if it is things like he's already promised that he's going to give you provision, and not in your wants, but he's going to give you your needs? What if he's already promised to give you what you have in store for eternity? He's going to give you protection from your enemies. What if you're like, God, why are you not doing this? You said you're going to. The question is, how do we rejoice in the midst of that? If he's never been late, even if it's later than we think, if he's never been late in coming through for his people, how do we rejoice in the midst of it, in the waiting? Because we know that ultimately it's for our good. Romans 5, 3 and 5 is a tough passage, but it's applicable. Romans 5, 3 and 5 says, we rejoice in our sufferings. Not after our sufferings. We rejoice in our sufferings. Why? Knowing that suffering produces endurance. Endurance produces character. Character produces hope. And hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who's been given to us. That's what Christ is doing as he allows you to experience some waiting, some trials, some suffering. He's drawing you to himself. He's getting you to keep your focus on him, not on everything working out according to your plan. He's getting you to focus on him alone. And it might take suffering for you to realize that. But in it, you also see that he's shaping you into his image. Endurance produces character. Like, what kind of character are we talking about? We're talking about Christ-likeness, that kind of character, that you become like Jesus in waiting, in suffering, in trials. You become more like Jesus if you're seeking him in the middle of it. Now, you can run away. You can experience suffering and trials. You can run away from God real fast. But that's not the point of them. That's not what he wants to do through those. He wants you to seek him in it and rejoice in it. So no matter what's going on around you or in your life right now or whatever will come in the future, know that Christ wants you to have a one thing focus on him, because you can trust him. He's going to come through for you, and you can find joy in him in the middle of all of it, and because he's going to give you that one thing focus, he's going to shape your life and bring that about in your life. Because it comes much more clear to the world around you that your focus is on him, even in the midst of trials. Like, you experience something that people would run away from God, and instead you press into God, and you run to him, and you struggle to fight the relationship with him. I want you, God. I want you in the midst of all this chaos. What kind of testimony is that to the world? Right? That's... They can look at us when everything's going right and everything's good in our lives. The world looks at us and be like, yeah, I can imagine why you would worship God. Makes sense, right? Everything's great in your life. Like, and it doesn't make an impact in their life. But when everything falls apart and you experience some of the worst trials and suffering and trials and struggles and difficulties that you can in your life, and you're still pursuing God, and you're still focused on him, that's whenever people around you start to notice. And it's confusing. But he gives it. Because the Lord himself is our strength and our deliverance. Not your own power, not your own toughness, not bucking up and saying, I can make it. Your world's falling apart, and Jesus is your only strength. So you can pursue him wholeheartedly with this one thing focused on him, no matter if it's going well or if it's going badly, you can still pursue him. But that leads us to this challenging question. That this answer of this question is revealed in your life when things do fall apart. That do you find God useful for your circumstances? Or do you find him glorious regardless of your circumstances? Is God simply your pharmacist that you call when you need him, but you don't talk to otherwise? Or is God your passion? See, it's kind of like you don't talk to a friend for like 5 years and then you call him to help you move. Right? Is that a real, that's a useful relationship, not a real intimate relationship, right? It's saying, God, I have no need for you until my life falls apart. And then I sure need you to fix my problems for me. That's a cosmic Santa Claus. That's not a God that's beautiful. God wants us to experience and know his glory all the time, not just when things are bad, not just whenever things are good, all the time. But you might be thinking at this moment, like, okay, you asked that question and it revealed something in my heart. I felt it. Okay, there's no way I can pursue Christ with that kind of focus. I can't have a one thing focus on him. There's no way. Or you might say, okay, I get it and I kind of want it, but to be honest, there's no way I can give up control of my life. You're asking me to give up control? I can't do that. Or you might be looking around the world and you think, man, the evil's winning. Like, there's no way we can have a one thing focus on Christ because look at what's going on. Like, or it might be, you might feel like everybody's abandoning you right now and you feel like there's no hope and I can't have a focus on God. I'm just trying to survive. Now, those are our all real feelings. But what's underneath all of that is a lack of trust that God is who he says he is, that he is sovereign and he will have victory over whatever you're facing, and that he is actually enough for you. Like, you want to add stuff on, you want to tag things on that, well, maybe God's really not all that I need. Maybe I need this and this and this and this. It's just a lack of trust in God. I pray that you see in Psalm 27 this challenge that he gives you, that where you're not trusting God, where other things have crept in and become your one thing focus, your one thing desire. Let me encourage you today to repent of that, to trust God, to trust Jesus as the center of every part of your life, willing to give up everything else for him. Now, you've heard me say that a lot. We say that a lot around here, willing to give up everything for Jesus. But my fear is that in America, we're not even willing to give up anything for Jesus. Like, we don't even have the conversation about giving up everything. Like, we're not even willing to give up anything for him. What do you mean, my time or money or my energy? Like, no. When it's convenient, yeah, That doesn't sound like following Jesus at all. We're so captured by all of these other gods, by all of these lesser desires, whether that's a boyfriend or a girlfriend. Even your spouse can become this, or your kids, or vacation trips, or money, or alcohol, or a perfect body, or sports, all of these things, when none of those will satisfy you. They're all lesser desires, and unfortunately, if we let them, they will crowd out our soul's greatest desire, our soul's greatest need, which is Jesus. You'll fill your life and clutter your life with everything else, and it will just numb you to the reality that what your soul is actually longing for is not that food or that drink or that experience or whatever it is. It's actually longing for Jesus. And it will just clutter it all up, and you will lose that. So what we need to have happen in our lives is we need to have all of those lesser affections be replaced with a much greater affection. That's why David asks here, God, give me a one thing focus. Give me a greater affection for you than anything else, even my safety. Even my comfort, God, give me a greater desire for you than that. Because David knows that when he pursues God above everything else, man, he's on the right track then. If God's my primary focus, I'm going to be in the right track. I'm going to go on the right path. That's all I know. So how do we do that? How do we replace these lesser desires with this greater affection? How do we do that? I think it's a simple question. What stirs your affections for Jesus? Like, what draws your heart to him? Just think about activities or locations or people that stir your affections. What is that? Well, it's going to be things like Bible study and prayer and fellowship among the saints and worship gatherings like this one and serving other people. But it might also be things like creation, just being in creation, seeing what he's created, or writing things to him, or singing things to him. Those things might stir your affections. Whatever those things are, do more of those things, right? Like, if this stirs your affections for Jesus, do more of that. It's going to increase your affections for him. But I think the other question is also true. What robs your affections for Jesus? What draws your hearts away from him? Blatant sin. Not repenting of sin. Not getting into his word. Maybe the people you're around draw your heart away from him. But it might also be simple stuff like TV or sports, technology, or wanting more toys, more stuff. Like, those things can turn your heart away too and steal your affections from Jesus. So whatever those things are, do less of those things. Right? It's not complicated. I want more affection for Jesus. I want less affection for these things. Do more of the things that are going to stir my affections for Jesus. Do less of the things that are going to rob my affections for Jesus. It's simple. Not easy. Because what the culture will say is that those things that steal your affections from Jesus, the culture will say those things are way more important. This is what you need to be involved in. This is what your kids need to be a part of. This is what you need to watch. This is what you need to do. But those things might steal your affections away from Jesus. And so we have to make a conscious decision. Even though it's a simple decision, it's a conscious, hard decision to say, no, I want to pursue Jesus. I want to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. That will, as the greater affection gets heavier and larger, the lesser affections will be crushed more by that greater affection. And you will see Jesus more beautifully than you ever have before. And so that's the question today. Is Jesus the treasure of your life? Are you seeking him like you would seek a buried treasure that you know is out there? Is Jesus that treasure for you? Or is he just useful for you? Is he a means to heaven? Is he a means to a better life? Is he beautiful to you? Where Jesus is the end you've been looking for. I pray that he's more attractive than ever before. And I want to pray for you towards that end right now.